Let's conclude our discussion about topological order. Of course, what you saw so far is just a gentle introduction. The topic is very large and very rich. One thing that I didn't mention yet is, okay, so we have seen that the low energy sector of topological ordered theories features excitations that can be boson or fermions or any other particle that you want. And in 2D, they can be anions, which means particles that have statistics that it is intermediate between bosons and fermions. And of course, like in all lattice theories, you can take the continuum limit and have a field theory. And the field theory of theories like this is a so-called topological quantum field theory, in which, yes, you have these interactions that are topological, so they do not depend on the distance. So, of course, one has to understand in what sense they do not violate the no-signaling condition that both in special relativity, as we have seen, because the Libby-Robinson bounds has to hold. So one more thing I want to show you that is actually very important to in the spirit of what we said so far. I have written the eigenstates of H of the toric code as An, so I'm using these quantum numbers, these quantum numbers, and then we add these two quantum numbers, right? That were specifying the two missing degrees of freedom. And you know, you should protest a little bit, because although this is a perfectly legitimate set of eigenstates for our Hamiltonian, and therefore also a basis in the Hilbert space, on what Hilbert space? Right? What Hilbert space is this? Because remember, we're not doing the gauge theory anymore. This should be the total Hilbert space, right? So we need to check whether this is indeed the basis for the total Hilbert space. So we know that the dimension of H tot is 2 to the 12 squared. And we know that these are linearly independent states because they're the eigenstates of an Hermitian operator. So we just need to count them, how many of them they are. If you have 2L squared basis states, then you're fine. Sorry, 2 to the 12 squared basis states, then you're fine. Then it's the basis. Okay, so let's count. Okay, so here, how many quantum numbers do we have? L squared minus 1. And here we have the same, L squared minus 1. And then we have 1 and 1. So you see that the sum of all these quantum numbers is 2 L squared. And so because these quantum numbers have two eigenvalues, they span at 2 to the L squared dimensional space. So they are, in fact, a basis in the total Hilbert space. because our total Hilbert space is this thing. And the way we've represented it is that this is what are these, you know, you see it explicitly. What is this tensor product? It's a tensor product of all these spaces, of all these spaces, and this space, and this space. At the same time, remember, the total Hilbert space is the Hilbert space of the spins on the bonds, the original spins, that are 2L squared, of course. So you see, both this Hilbert space, the Hilbert space that is the tensor product of this, and the Hilbert space that is the tensor product of these two-level systems, they are both isomorphic to this. But these are two different tensor product structures, right? Because one is the tensor product structure of the single spins, right? In one case, we are writing H dot as the tensor product of L, the links in the lattice, and then we have the H local that is a spin one half with the spins on the lattice, and in the other case is the tensor product of what I can call HA N, right? The Hilbert space spanned by this degree of freedom tensor, the Hilbert space spanned by this degree of freedom tensor, the one spanned, so let me call it HW1 tensor HW2. So these two Hilbert spaces are isomorphic, of course, but they have, so they are the same Hilbert space, but they have two different tensor product structures. And the tensor product structure is what tells you what are the, you know, the local degrees of freedom. And now you see that, of course, with respect to the gauge theory, the only thing that happened is that we added this. But as long as we write the states in this basis, we still have this problem that we have these two non-local Hilbert spaces. But now, because H dot is also this one, there should be a way of writing these eigenstates in this basis that is physical, right? Because these are all local. These are all just spins one half. It has to be possible because that is a basis. So let's see how we do that. So let's start with the ground state. Okay, and then we will build the excitations. Why it's easy to build the excitations? Because we know that once you have the ground state, any excitation is produced, by excitation I mean an eigenstate of higher energy, is produced by applying some open string operator of the type X or Z. If it is of the type X, I create a pair of vortices, which means excitations here. If the type Z, I create a pair of charges, of Z2 charges, that is excitations of the A quantum numbers. I also said that there is this interesting phenomenon that all the isotopic curves, isotopic means at the same place, that have the same endpoints, create the same excitations. This should be obvious from you know, the task to be like that should be obvious because the excitations are only labeled by this. But one would like to understand why these two operators do actually the same thing on the state. Because on the face of it, they are different operators. Okay, so we need to write psi zero in this basis, in the basis of the local spins, and then we go from there. Now remember that some state belongs to the ground state manifold if it's an eigenstate of eigenvalue 1 of all the n and all the bp. Right? This is the condition of being in the ground state. Because the Hamiltonian is just the sum over these constraints. Right? Okay. And we know that to find the common eigenstate of all these operators of eigenvalue plus one, we saw it. We just need to project onto the subspaces of those constraints. So let's do it explicitly. Okay? So I can start from any state I want, but I will try to be clever. Because if I choose any state in, not any state, but there are some state in the Z basis, in the computational basis of the spins, that automatically obey all the BP's constraints. So for instance, imagine that you take the state 0 tensor n, that from now on I will call 0 tilde. So it's all spins up as a reference state. Well, now you see that for every p, bp on 0 tilde is 0 tilde. Right? Bp is just a product of sigma z matrices, so and the identity everywhere else. So if I apply it on the state of all spins up, automatically this satisfies all the constraints. Okay. So I just need to project over the AN as we did when we did the gauge theory. Right? So psi zero, I can write it as that projector, that was the product of all my projection operators onto zero tilde, where Pn is the identity plus An over 2. Do you agree? So let's do that. Let's actually see explicitly when we project starting from this reference state. So you see now we are in the basis of the spins. Yeah.
This projection need not go out of this zero space. I mean, if we first project BP, then project A.
They all commute.
Yeah.
So you can make the projections in you know, that's an excellent point. So if we had if our operators in the theory were not commuting, we couldn't do it this way. So when hopefully in part two or in any case it will be in the notes, you will see how to do other gauge theories, more general gauge theories. So you will have even a non-abelian groups, because you know Z2 is abelian, it's easy, and Zn is abelian, but you know, you could have any non-abelian group. You will have to make a construction such that in the Hamiltonian is still made of commuting operators, because we still want to use these methods. So of course that is more challenging, but it can be done. Okay, so let's do this calculation. So this is Pn 1 plus An over 2, 0 tilde. And I can actually get rid of this over 2 at this point. Why? Because projections do not conserve the norm. Right? So in the end, after I do many projections, as you know, right? I have a certain length. I do a projection and I'm here. And if this was of length 1, now this is not of length 1. But to be a state in a hill in to be a quantum state, it's not okay to just be a vector in the Hilbert space. I have to renormalize it. Okay. So because in the end I have to normalize it anyway, I can get rid of this n at this point. Okay, so let me just write this. Although at this point, okay, so let me write it like this. So that psi 0 is equal to some calligraphic n that will be our normalization times this. Okay. So now let's expand this product. And when you expand this product, you have the identity plus the sum over all the ans. Then you will have the sum over all this. Do you agree? Then you will have the sum over all this. And so on. Right? This is what I'm doing. Do you agree with that? Okay. So now I can do a trick. As you can see, this is all the possible products of some ans. Right? In fact, for instance, if I have an and I make the product with the same an, I get the identity. If I have the product of an with the identity, I get some an, so I have all the possible ans. Or I have all the possible products of ans at different sites. Right? So these are all the possible products of ans. So consider this set, which is what I said. So we use this notation, it's called associative group. It's just the set of all the products of these operators. So it's like the span, but it's not a linear combination, it's all the possible products. Well, this is a group, obviously, because it contains the identity, as we have seen. It's closed under this multiplication. And we know very well that for these operators, there is always the inverse, which is itself, right? Because they square to the identity. So it's a group. And what is usually very hard to compute in a group is the number of elements, the cardinality of a group. That's a hard problem. However, it is not hard for Z2. I mean, this is Z2 times Z2 times Z2n times, right? So the cardinality, so how many of these operators do we have? Remember, it's L squared minus 1. Okay. So, so this cardinality is, because this is a cyclic group and the cycle is 2, so basically, which is the same thing, oh, the square to the identity, there are only 2 to the L square minus 1 possible products. So I'm hesitating because I just need to. Okay, yeah. So okay. So this means that this n, so this is the sum over all the elements of G, right? So this means that this is equal 1 over the square root of G, of the cardinality G times the sum over all the group elements on this reference state. And now I will define this notation. So this is equivalent to square root of the cardinality, the sum over all the g's of just j. Ket g means the operator g applied to the reference state. Okay? So you see, this is a very interesting property because this is the average of the group. And from group theory, so first of all, let's give a physical interpretation to these objects. So, of course, they are these objects. And this is a product of A operators. And you remember that the product of A operators, what is it? You have to tell me. It's a loop carrying X. Great. So you see, that we are saying our ground state is an equal superposition of all the possible loop configurations. It's a loop gas. It's coherent loop gas. It's a coherent superposition. And now with this property, so of course, right now what I've done, I have just picked one state in your LGS. What is it? You see, I picked one state in your LGS, but you know how to get to the other ones. You just apply your non-contractible loop operators. Okay, so in this way you have these four sectors. In every sector, you have a soup of loops, a loop gas. And so I'll give you one of the properties, but with this property, you can understand in the physical spins all the properties of topological order, and it is this. Let's say that I take a G tilde in G, and I want to look at G tilde psi 0, okay, then this is equal to G tilde 1 over square root of G. So let me put this under the sum, right? This is what you get. Well, and you see that what GG tilde does is to associate you univocally to a new group element. So you are just reshuffling all the group elements, and so you get the same superposition as before, which is psi zero. This is another way of saying the group average, this is a very general thing, is invariant under the elements of the group. Now, because of this, now you understand that. Because you can, why isotopic strings give you the same state? Because you can write this string as this string times some g, right? Because remember, loops are what deforms the string. And now you see that when this acts on psi zero, this just gets absorbed. This was I just proved. And therefore, this operator has the same action of this operator on the ground state. There are many, many, many other properties that we could play with. One very interesting thing to understand is to understand how entangled is this state. Entanglement and topological order are very, it's a very interesting topic. Because one of the things that we have not discussed is, okay, now we know that these faces have the same symmetry. So different topological faces have the same symmetry. And we have only seen what distinguishes the topologically ordered face from the paramagnet, oh, it's this degeneracy. But in terms of some operator, we would like to have an order parameter, something that you can measure, and you say, oh, it's topologically ordered, and it is this type of topological order, like Z2, instead of something else. And this is challenging. All we know is that this order parameter cannot be local, right? Because if it were local, this would be symmetry breaking. One other possibility that enriches very much these things is that you have at the same time topological ordering and symmetry breaking. You can mix the two effects. In fact, you can mix them in a non-trivial way, meaning that only in the symmetry broken face of two faces, there is topological order. This is called symmetry protected topological order. So the theory of topological orders is very, very rich, and the classification is not complete. It's a beautiful piece of math, and it's a very fruitful field of research. Just like the applications of topological order, like you know how you can build a resilient state that is resilient to thermal excitations, or how you can do universal quantum computations and all these things. But this would take us to so far. Okay, so we conclude our discussion on topological order now, and so you see that the first goal of this course was to show you what is order, how order depends on the interplay between what is local and what is not local, and how, when we understand that, then we are able to imagine that there's something beyond symmetry breaking, and then we found it. Okay, so this is the short story of what we did. And in the meanwhile, we learned a bunch of techniques of things that hopefully now you know how to use. Okay, so now we change topic. Still in the spirit of this course is quantum matter. So what is that emerges? What is that is a property of a system of many particles? And that is a property of many different systems, not just condensed matter systems. And so far, we've been talking of equilibrium states. And to make things simpler, we went to the ground state at t equals zero, because in that case, all the phase transitions that we were considering were driven by quantum fluctuations. Otherwise, at finite temperature, you have a mixing of the two things. It actually becomes very complicated that, strictly speaking, you cannot distinguish that. That there are profound reasons why. But now we want to be away from equilibrium. And okay, so this is a very, very interesting story. We want to understand how in quantum mechanics things reach equilibrium. And this is a story that has been going on for thousands of years, literally. In fact, the first physical law that was discovered in 6th century before Christ is the fact that actually it was enunciated in a poem, because at that time people would write essays in a lyrical way. So in Greece, Heraclitus said, everything that is dry, damp becomes dry, everything that is dry becomes damp, what is cold warms up, and what is hot cools down. No? It's thermalization. Things can be prepared away from equilibrium, but then they reach an equilibrium state. And this equilibrium state is not just any equilibrium state, it's the thermal state. And the difference between the equilibrium state, so now let me sketch something that doesn't make sense, but that will, it's just a cartoon, okay? An equilibrium state, if this is time, is something that at some point stops evolving. It has reached equilibrium. But in principle, you could go back, because this equilibrium state could remember everything about the initial conditions. So this is equilibration. But thermalization is something stronger, because it's saying, no matter what are the initial conditions, I will equilibrate to the thermal state that is unique. It's the Gibbs state. When I say unique, I mean unique mod beta. So it's parameterized by beta, the temperature. So, but it's just one parameter, right? So definitely with one parameter, you cannot classify all the quantum states. You know, they're very high dimensionality spaces. So this means that, you know, it thermalization is a process that is many to one.
Is it possible to finish thermalization in finite time?
This is an extremely important point. So we know experimentally, that's why it was the first law that it was ever discovered, that it does happen in finite time. Okay, otherwise we wouldn't know about that. But I will come back to this point because it's extremely important. So you see, just from the logical point of view, you know, I'm not doing any math right now, but this has to be reversible. Because how, you know, how I can revert it if I don't know where to go? You know, all these things are encoded in modern physics in what is called the second principle of thermodynamics, that says entropy always increases, and energy is conserved in a cross quantum system, but entropy is always increasing. And you know, you do your stat mac, and you get to this. And there is something very important that if there is one law of physics you should never mess with, is the second principle of thermodynamics. The second principle of thermodynamics is the only law of physics that has never been updated. All the other laws of physics have been changed, right? So we define energy, momentum, we say they are conserved. Then we discover that they're not conserved. So what we do is that we redefine these quantities so that they are conserved. Right? For instance, when you discover that also the electromagnetic field, you can associate a quantity called momentum. But what is it? That's a definition. It's a trick so that now you say, oh, the sum of these two things is conserved. So you have redefined momentum. You know, the mechanical momentum plus the momentum in the electromagnetic field is conserved. But second principle of thermodynamics has never been updated, and it will never be. And you know, Sir Arthur Eddington said, hey, do what you want, don't touch that, or you know, you're gonna be in trouble. And this is very strange because the second principle of thermodynamics is not, technically speaking, a fundamental law. It's something that happens and it's very solid, but it is not a fundamental law. All the fundamental laws are time reversal. Second principle of thermodynamics has an arrow of time. So the main problem of statistical mechanics and also in quantum statistical mechanics is how can this be? How can you, from time reversal laws, get to equilibration and then thermalization? Okay. So let's see. So now we are in quantum mechanics, and our setup is that we have, you know, our Hilbert space, we know it's local, and then we have our Hamiltonian, and I will write it in this way. Okay, in its spectral resolution, that I can also write in this way. And to be really precise, I should do this, right? Because your Hamiltonian could be degenerate, but we will be concerned with the case of non-degenerate Hamiltonian. And the reason why this is not a big loss of generality will be clear later. And we know that time evolution is completely defined by the Hamiltonian. So you know that any operator x at the time t is what we call ut of x. A ut is the adjoint action generated by this unitary operation. So this is a super operator, right? It's an operator that acts on operators. And these are just operators where u of t is, of course, this one. The exponentiation of the Hamiltonian. And now you can see that if I am declaring this, these are our definitions for the time evolution, it means that we are in a closed quantum system, right? There is nothing else. So I have my system, and it's closed. There is no environment, no bath. You also remember from statistical mechanics that you've done, at least in the classical case, that the way you reach thermalization is that you have your system away from equilibrium and you put it in contact with the bath at a fixed temperature. which is a larger physical system that has thermalized. You know, and then then there is this question, like, how could this thermalize? How could this thermalize? Oh, then it needs a bigger bath. And then you keep asking, and then you have the whole universe. And, you know, so the usual story that we learn when we study physics, statistical physics, is that, oh, this works. No, I get the right numbers. But it's conceptually very unsatisfying because it is asking you, it's begging for this question, right? What happened to this? It is a little bit like the story, the philosopher William James, around 100 years ago, was giving a talk about cosmology and was explaining the cosmological, at the time, model of the universe. And there was a lady in the audience and said that had studied a lot of Indian philosophy. I don't know if a lot, but she had studied some, or she thought she had studied some. I have to do all these disclaimers. But the story is true. She said, oh, everyone knows that the Earth, you know, rests on the back of a tortoise, no, of an elephant. And then, you know, William just said, yeah, but then you have to ask the question about the elephant. And the lady said, oh, and then that rests on the back of a huge tortoise. And William just said, oh, what about the tortoise? Another tortoise. And they said, yeah, but what about it? You know, what about the next tortoise? He said, oh, it's tortoises all the way down. And this is a very funny story, right? Because it's philosophically ridiculous, it's untenable. And believe it or not, this is what we behave today when we talk about thermalization. So you see why we have to address that. Okay, so if we have to understand thermalization in quantum system, it must be a closed quantum system. Okay. So this is the setting. This is the setting of a closed quantum system. And let's see if this can happen. OK, so let's try something like the second principle of thermodynamics, second law, the one that you should never mess with. And you want to compute the entropy of a state at the time t. Of course, the state at the time t is given by a similar expression. And to be totally precise, it's just the dagger of it. Okay. Okay, so let's do that. So we know that this is the What is psi of t is just u c u dagger. And you also know that every state can be written in its spectral resolution. So you have some populations and some projectors. And you know that the entropy of a state is defined. I think you have just done some homework about entropy, right? So it's defined, so the entropy of order alpha as 1 over 1 minus alpha, the log of the trace of phi to the alpha. And for instance, for alpha going to 1, you have the Shannon entropy that for the quantum case is called von Neumann entropy, S1 of phi will be equal to minus the sum over n pn log pn. Okay, where pn are really these guys. Okay, so as you can see, entropy, and this is true also for this, depending on how familiar you are with functions of density operators, you should see it, are just a function, the entropies are just a function of the spectrum of the operator. Basically of the PNs. Well, now we are saying that the entropy of my psi of t is the entropy of this. But now you see that this unitary operator is a change of basis. So it doesn't change the spectrum of this matrix. So this must be equal to the entropy of this thing, which is the entropy of the initial state, the one without the t. There you go. Entropy is constant in quantum mechanics. So, and because thermalization does involve an increase of entropy, why? Imagine this is a pure state. Its entropy is zero, right? It means the Pn is, this probability distribution is 1, 0, 0, 0. This is a pure state. But this is not a pure state. The eigenvalue, the spectrum of these things are, this is the spectrum, e to the minus beta en over z. So this is not pure at all. Only for infinite beta this becomes pure because you get to the ground state, assuming the ground state is unique. Otherwise, it's a probability distribution. It's the Boltzmann probability distribution. So this has entropy. This has no entropy. So you know, we have just proven that thermalization is impossible in quantum mechanics. What about equilibration? Equilibration is something weaker. And say, you know, maybe equilibration in some sense is reversible, could be reversible. So it's compatible with this fact, but at least equilibrates. So what we are looking at is that we have some initial state, and then this evolves in time as phi t that we've defined there. And then at some point for some time greater than some t star, it becomes some equilibrium state. And this equilibrium state does not evolve anymore. In other words, it's a fixed point of u. Okay, so u phi x is phi x. This means to be a fixed point. So this is what equilibration is. So notice that we do not mean, so we are excluding from the beginning the trivial case. The trivial case is that the initial state is already the equilibrium state. Of course, this is possible. You start with a steady state, then it will never evolve. But it's not equilibration. Equilibration is the phenomenon that you have something away from equilibrium, that it does evolve and then it stops evolving. So let's try to understand the nature of these fixed points in quantum mechanics, fixed points of the unitary evolution, the steady states. What are they? When is a state? For what condition phi is steady or a fixed point? These are synonymous.
And the
eigenstates definitely do not evolve. It's only the eigenstates. I mean, look, you know, not only, for instance, the Gibbs state does not evolve. Right? Otherwise, how could be the thermal state? So at the very least, it's not just the eigenstates. The Gibbs state is not an eigenstate, right?
The minimal, the most possible state?
The most general state that is a steady state.
Maximize the entropy.
No, the eigenstates have a minimum entropy. They have zero entropy, right? They're pure states and they're steady states.
Yeah, that's why it's not a steady state.
An eigenstate is a steady state, right? Because it's invariant under time evolution. That's why it's an eigenstate. So this is true if and only if phi commutes with the Hamiltonian. Which in turn means that phi is a function of the Hamiltonian. So of course, an eigenstate is a function of the Hamiltonian. And this is a function of the Hamiltonian. Because every function of the Hamiltonian commutes with the Hamiltonian, right? OK, so these are the steady states. So of course, there is the possibility that you start from an equilibrium state, and then it never evolves. This is trivial. But what we really want is this. So let's see if this is possible in quantum mechanics. OK? So the way I want to do it is to compute the difference between phi at the time t and phi at equilibrium. And I want a distance between these states. And let me take this north. Okay? I want to see how different they are. These are the density operators, so this is a good distance. OK, so let's play with that. And we actually want to know, of course, at the beginning, these states have some distance. But I want to know at the end if phi of t will have equilibrated. And I don't know how long it takes. But if it's equilibrating, then this must be true in the infinite time limit. Because you know, right now we don't know what is the equilibration time scale. But if there is equilibration, then it must be forever. So let me take the limit of t going to infinity of this. OK, so now let's play. So we have a limit of this. And what is u, phi of t is u phi, right? And you also know that phi equilibrium is a u phi equilibrium. And you also know that u is a linear operator. And you also know that it is. Yeah, say it aloud, please. Norm-preserving. So now this is equal to the norm of phi minus phi ak, right? And you know, I can drop the limit. Why? Because now these are two constants. You see, they do not depend on time. So if I equilibrate, means that this is zero. But if I equilibrate, then this is zero, which means that phi is the equilibrium state, the initial state, which is what I wanted to rule out. So the only way that I can stop evolving is that I never evolved. So I just proved you that in quantum mechanics, equilibration is impossible. Huh. Right? Because the most fundamental thing that we knew since 6th century before Christ, it's impossible. So how like Alice said, how many impossible things you can get to believe in a day? Yeah? Let's try to believe an impossible thing. Okay, so let's see. In this course, we also have learned something. I mean, not explicitly, but it was always there underneath, that what really matters in quantum mechanics is not the wave function, but the expectation values of operators, the observables. So that's why von Neumann, following Heisenberg, started to rephrase everything in terms of operators, because those are our data. This also shows you that in some sense, the wave function is not physical, it's a mathematical device. And that's why many questions about the nature of a mathematical device, in some sense, at least, you know, I think so, are misplaced. The physics is the physics of the observables. And so I will call the expectation value at the time of t of some observable, it will be the trace of at in phi. This is the Heisenberg representation, where at is defined there. It's what I call xt. You also know this is the same thing than the trace of a in phi t. This also explains why phi t evolves with the dagger of a. Okay, so these are the expectation values. Now these are numbers, actually real numbers. And now we are asking something weaker, that is this. Is it possible that a of t equilibrates? Who cares if the wave function equilibrates or not? It's a of t that has to equilibrate. This is what we observe. We never observe the wave function. And unfortunately not. So there is a theorem by von Neumann that says A of T is quasi-periodic there is a similar theorem in classical mechanics. It says for every initial condition, for every operator, there is a time capital T such, and for every error epsilon, there is a time capital T epsilon such that A of T minus A at the time zero is for T for A T epsilon is smaller than epsilon, for any epsilon greater than zero. So that you get arbitrarily close to the initial value for a suitable T. And usually people refer to this, the T that is the common time for all the possible observables is called Poincaré recurrence time. So at the very least, it means that at some point we start evolving again, so it has not equilibrated.
2 minutes.
Yep. Good, I can make it. So you see, it's starting getting impossibler and impossibler, this thing. So do you have any suggestion? What is that could happen that suits our observations, that things do equilibrate? No?
Open system,
right. So open system works because the evolution open system, I can show you later, tomorrow, is not unitary. And therefore, not being unitary, we cannot apply the theorem. We know it works. There is a problem of tortoises. Okay. So as I said, if we want to really understand this, it must be in the closed system.
Can T be very, very big?
This T epsilon can be very, very, very big. And therefore?
Well, I mean, if it's so big that the universe has evolved for it, we could in principle say that we're in the equilibrium zone.
Mm. Okay. That's a very good suggestion. So let's make it in 1 minute a little bit more precise. Okay. Imagine that your evolution is of this type. So you start, then you have something like this. Okay? An actual completely flat profile is not possible. It's a more complicated proof, but it has to do with that proof of unitarity. But what you could have is something like this. So this would mean that the probability of finding A of t different from some reference value, let me call it A bar, the probability of finding that this difference is greater than some k is very small. Right? Do you know anything in statistics? Now, physics is based on statistics. Because in the end, it's an experimental science, so you need to understand what it means to have an error. So no matter how much math we draw, in the end, it's an experimental science. Do you know, in statistics, it's the most important theorem of all, is what you unconsciously use all the time, every time you say, oh, this is experimentally verified. It's a theorem about this. That you want to say that the observed value is actually the theoretical value, because you want to say that this probability of being different from the real value is very small. And what do you say? What do you say? Oh, I believe. Why you believe LHC? Because the deviations are out of 5 sigma, so there must be a sigma involved. Right? So this means that these observed values have a distribution, and there is a sigma, and you want this thing to be smaller than sigma over k. So this means that if your distribution is peaked, then this probability is small. This is the basis of all experimental physics, called the Chebyshev inequality. Now, this is possible in quantum mechanics. This is not contradicting unitarity, that this sigma for this distribution of values is very small. Okay? So maybe this is what is happening. The so-called equilibration in probability means sigma is small. And let's remember what is sigma. Sigma is actually so sigma square is the variance of A over this ensemble. I'm writing this and then I go. What is the variance of A? Is A minus the average, that's why I called it A bar, the real value, squared, averaged. So if you want to prove that there is this type of equilibration, this is okay. Right? It says the probability that they observe something different from what I call equilibrium value is very, very, very small, so I don't see it. It's called equilibration in probability. It is as good as it gets anything that is experimentally verified. that is always a probability statement. It means that this variance must be small over this ensemble. What ensemble is this? What is the label of this ensemble?
T.
Say?
Time.
Time. See, you see, for every T, we have a value. So these are the temporal fluctuations. So tomorrow, we will prove a very beautiful theorem that says under which condition temporal fluctuations become infinitesimally small. And if this is true, we have proven the first impossible thing that we will believe, that equilibration happens.